This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. A new study has been released by the CDC that shows that the third dose or booster vaccine for COVID-19 may lose its effectiveness over time. The nationwide study also included experts from Indiana. With us now are two of the researchers involved in the project, Brian Dixon, Director of Public Health Informatics, Regan Streef Institute and Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health, and Dr. Sean Granis, Vice President of Data and Analytics at the Regan Streef Institute and a Professor of Family Medicine at the IU School of Medicine. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us today. I want to start with you, Brian. Can you give us a breakdown of what an mRNA vaccine is before we get into all the details of this study?
Absolutely. First of all, thanks for inviting me to come today. Pleasure to be here. And yeah, let's start with the vaccine. So an mRNA vaccine is really a vaccine that uses a particular technology to deliver information to the human body on how to fight off an infection from a particular virus. So in this case, the microRNA technology is the type of technology that's being used in the vaccine. And so it uses essentially genetic code to be passed into the human body so that our natural immune system can take that code and use it to fight off infection from the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So the technology has been around for almost 20 years now. It really got started when the National Institutes of Health kicked off its Human Genome Project. From that project, we learned a lot about the different types of cellular technologies and how we might be able to develop vaccines using this mRNA technology. This pandemic has really been the first time that we've been able to take all of that knowledge and use it to quickly develop a vaccine for population distribution.
That's really fascinating because I think for a lot of us, this is the first time we've ever heard of something called an mRNA vaccine. You know, I just think we assumed vaccines are something that's made in a lab and you know, we got to get them from time to time. But there's so much more technicality to that. Are there any other examples outside of the COVID-19 vaccine that uses mRNA?
Sean?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So recall when Ebola last raised its head in the world and came to the United States, if people can remember that time period, and a viable mRNA vaccine was being developed at that time. It didn't get widespread use, though it was shown to be effective in limited studies. So we've had, you know, this concept of an mRNA vaccine for some time, but quite frankly, the pandemic is the first time at scale that we've been leveraging this technology. But I think it's important, though, to point out that we've had other types of the mRNA as a vector. It is a piece of code that goes into the cell to help the cell produce pieces of the virus, not the whole virus, but pieces of it. We've had this type of thing through other delivery mechanisms before. So we've often used other viruses to get viral code into a cell. So the concept of getting messenger RNA into the cell to produce parts of the virus, that's been around for quite some time. The technology is simply getting better and better. Witness the effectiveness and safety of the mRNA vaccines that we've seen thus far.
I'm glad you pointed that out. I mean, that gives clarification probably for a lot of folks, including myself, learning just about how vaccines work, that this is not something that's just brand new and has never been done before. It's just the way that it's being delivered is a little bit different.
Yes.
Well, I want to talk about the study that has come out showing the waning effects of a third shot. We'll start with you, Brian. How did this study get started?
So we are we here at the Regan Streef Institute and the School of Public Health and School of Medicine are part of a national network of academic researchers that partnered together with the CDC shortly after the vaccines were approved. And we formed a network in order to sort of monitor the effectiveness of vaccines over time. So we've been in the background collecting data for quite a while now, since the beginning of 2021, when we began to vaccinate the population against SARS-CoV-2. And so this study really came out of our network's collective thinking that we should really look into the waning effects of the vaccine over time. So most of us lose immunity from vaccinations that we've had over time. So for example, you get a booster shot for tetanus every 10 years. Most people get an annual flu shot. There's periodic shots for shingles, for example, particularly for older adults. And so this concept that your immunity would wane over time is well known. And so we hypothesized that it would also occur with the vaccines that were being given for COVID-19 pandemic. And so we've been collecting data on hospitalizations and emergency department visits, in our case, across the state of Indiana. And then we pooled that data together with data from other states to look at, for individuals who've received the booster shot starting last fall, how long, you know, had it been since they received their booster shot, and did they end up then back, you know, infected with the virus and in a healthcare facility for treatment?
Sean, how does Indiana play into this study? Is it because it's part of a national study, or is there anything specific to our state?
Sure. Well, Indiana has some of the most health information technology infrastructure in the country. For example, at the Regan Street Institute, developed health information exchange technology, technology that allows us to connect clinical systems to exchange data with public health. And frankly, Indiana has been a leader in this space for some time. In fact, the field of public health informatics recently emerged, and I think through the great work that people like Brian are doing in this space, to show how you can use information technology to support public health activity. Well, we've built that infrastructure and we've been leveraging it for several years. This isn't our first project with the CDC, nor is it the only project that we have with the CDC right now, because of that infrastructure that allows us to safely and securely share data with public health and get a better understanding what's happening in the population. And so from that perspective, Regan Streif is, and Indiana University investigators are well-positioned to support public health use cases and, you know, exactly circumstances like this. Recall back when H1N1 came out in 2009, because we had our health information exchange, which connects clinical systems and also public health systems, the CDC reached out to us before there was actually a test for H1N1 to be able to look at signals for the virus. And so we've actually been doing work like this for well over a decade, in fact, close to two decades.
Brian, what is your role in the study, and what have you been able to do?
Yeah, so our role in the study is kind of multifaceted. So the first thing that we do is as I'm one of several investigators in the study, so we propose ideas to the network to say, here's an interesting research question. Let's try to use the data to pursue this. To operationalize that, we form working groups. And so I'm kind of the Regan Streif lead to the what's known as the Waning Immunity Working Group. And so our working group meets on a weekly basis to look at the data, monitor the trends. And once we had enough information, then data gathered on people who had been vaccinated and then ended up, you know, in the hospital, so we could compare against the unvaccinated. Then we started to do the data analysis and look at what the data were telling us so that we could prepare this report. So our role is really one, to look at the data, validate it, fact check it all the time, since we're multiple institutions sharing data as part of this network, and then also to contribute to the analysis and interpretation of it so that we can put together reports like the one we released last week.
And Sean, are you playing a similar role as Brian?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. As you said, it's a very collaborative effort. We have our internal local site work where we make sure that we're providing high quality data, appropriate data. And as Brian says, we are routinely validating, verifying data quality, and then similarly participating in different working groups, as Brian mentioned. For example, I'm the liaison to the natural immunity working group, where we're studying the effect of natural immunity as compared to vaccination and combinations therein.
We have about a minute left before we go to break. I'm curious, how did this study begin? You mentioned, Brian, there was a hypothesis about the effectiveness of vaccines. Where did it all start from?
I think it all started with, we knew that as vaccinations began to roll out in the population, that there would be a lot of questions that would come up about how well the vaccines would perform, right? How are they safe? Are they effective? How long does immunity last? How many boosters will people need? How often will people need to be kind of boosted your body retaught that code to fight off the virus and monitor things as various variants emerge in the population. So these are things that we discussed and planned for. And so that's really where the idea came from, is that we would really need to be looking at the data and then monitoring it so that we could inform the dialogue about natural or the need for boosting over time.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to get more into detail about vaccine effectiveness and what this study revealed. If you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about a new study released by the CDC that addresses the third dose or booster vaccine for COVID-19 and that it may lose its effectiveness over time. With us are Brian Dixon, Director of Public Health Informatics at the Regan Streef Institute in Indiana University, Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health, and Dr. Sean Granis, Vice President of Data and Analytics at the Regan Streef Institute and a Professor of Family Medicine at the IU School of Medicine. Before the break, sort of touched a little bit about how this study got started and what you were looking at. I'm curious, Sean, how was the study conducted and how many people were observed? Is that something that you're able to find out, or is this just random data that you're looking through?
Sure. No, there. We use a formal research methodology for this, and every one of the sites participates and provides data in a consistent fashion. So we essentially define cohorts of individuals who received the vaccine, did not receive the vaccine, and then we looked at their outcomes. These individuals, by the way, had similar health-seeking behaviors as well. So these were individuals who were seeking care for COVID-like illness, which would be a respiratory illness, symptoms of respiratory disease like cough, shortness of breath, fever, chills, etc. So we have these two cohorts, and then we look at their outcomes over time. We know, so everybody has known prior to the pandemic that vaccines do protect against infection. But I think a lot of people have learned during the pandemic that vaccines aren't just good at protecting against that infection. They're also valuable at preventing subsequent outcomes, like having to visit an emergency department, like having to be hospitalized, like dying. And so we've been studying those outcomes, those sequelae, as we say, visits to the emergency department or visits to the hospital. And so in this study, we looked at 241,000 emergency department or urgent care visits, and 93,000 hospitalizations. So that was the study population that we looked at.
That's a lot of data to comb through, but also I'm curious how you're able to obtain that data, Brian. Is this publicly available data? Is it things that folks have to consent to?
It's not publicly available data, but it is data that's gathered through routine healthcare processes. So, for example, as Sean mentioned earlier, we use the Indiana Health Information Exchange to facilitate this research here in Indiana. And so when someone goes into a healthcare facility in Indiana that's part of the Health Information Exchange, they consent to have their information be shared with the Health Information Exchange for treatment purposes, for payment purposes, for public health purposes. And so what we really are doing is taking the data from the Health Information Exchange and using it in this project. So when we send the data, though, to CDC, it's completely identified. We're sending, you know, de-identified records, so they don't know who the person is who's been hospitalized. They just know that study subject one has been hospitalized for a COVID-like illness and that either had or did not have the vaccine. And in this study, we also looked at people who had, you know, two doses of the vaccine versus three doses of the vaccine. And so those kind of details are in the data set, but not anything about the person. And so really that's the data are collected in a very natural way as people get infected, they get sick, they seek healthcare in Indiana. We're in our health information exchanges in the background collecting those data. Clinicians are using those data to inform their clinical decision making and using them to monitor their own patients. But then we are subsequently using those data to study population health trends.
Sean, what did you uncover with this study? What conclusion did you come away with, or is this something you're going to continue to look at?
Well, certainly it will be something that we continue to look at. So we know, as Brian mentioned, we know that immunity wanes over time and we want to stay on top of that. So I think there'll be more to come there. This study, though, in particular, I think the primary conclusion would be the following. Although protection against COVID-19 among adults decreased with time, we saw that it did decrease with time since getting the third dose of mRNA vaccine. The vaccines were still highly protective against the virus. And in particular, that third dose, that booster dose, as people are calling it, significantly improved effectiveness beyond the second dose. So we think these results very clearly provide good data-driven support for getting that booster shot.
What will be done with this data once you have this sort of information in front of you that it kind of wanes with time? Does that mean we're going to see more shots in the future, Brian, like every couple months?
Yeah, so I do think that the data that we put in this report will also be shared with the policymakers, particularly the committees at the FDA and the CDC that make decisions about policy and guidelines and recommendations around future doses of the COVID-19 vaccine. And so I think we can certainly expect those individuals to be highly interested in these findings and use it to try to figure out what that timeline looks like. So as Sean mentioned, we're going to continue to study this. I think based on these data, 4 months after the booster dose was given, there was still a very high level of protection against hospitalization in particular, which is very good. So even though it waned sort of statistically, it did not wane very dramatically, right? You didn't go from having high level protection to zero protection. You went from having a very high level to a high level of protection. So I think that's something the committees can use to understand maybe what the timing for the future dose looks like. Probably not 6 months would be my guess based on the data in this study, but it's likely to be something further off. So it could be at 9 months, it could be at a 1 year mark. So that I think is what we will figure out in the future as we continue to monitor the trends.
Sean, was there any information you were able to glean from this study of where Indiana stands versus other states with vaccination rates or just the effectiveness of vaccine? Is that something you looked into?
Sure. This study did not do a state-by-state comparison. We tend to integrate or aggregate this data into a population whole. We do certainly, through other means, we track and understand Indiana's overall immunization rate, and the state health department does a very good job of sharing that information on their dashboard as well. But the goal of the network at this point has been to look at the population overall. That's why we have sites, you know, from the East Coast to the West Coast, from New York to California. We want to get a good snapshot of the country to tell the overall picture. We do have local data with which we are working on some additional studies. So we may be able to provide some more Indiana-specific data in the coming days and weeks.
Ryan, are you concerned at all that folks who hear about this study, that vaccine effectiveness wears off with time, could cause people to become more vaccine hesitant if they aren't already?
I think that that is a concern. I think that's a lot of the reason why we're trying to get messaging around that, that even though there's some waning, that there's still a high level of protection with the third dose. So I think there is some concern there. I don't think the study says, you know, you should panic if you've gotten the third dose, like you're no longer protected. But for those who haven't gotten the third dose, I think the study shows that even though there's some waning, you know, 4 months after administration, the people with three doses fared much better in terms of their protection against hospitalization than individuals who only had two doses of the vaccine, and that immunity had waned over. Had waned more over time during the Omicron period.
Is there a possibility that the messaging has become so confusing for folks that in terms of vaccine hesitancy? I'm just thinking how you're mentioning that it protects against severe illness or hospitalization. And I think maybe there's this misperception that you're going to get the vaccine and you're going to be golden. Nothing will ever, you know, interfere with you.
Yeah, I do think there is some confusion out there, and it is challenging because there are several studies that came out before ours that showed that even if you had the booster shot, you could still get infected, right? What we call breakthrough cases. So an infection, of course, you know, for the vaccinated is not as big of a deal, right, as those who are unvaccinated, right, which is what our study shows. The protection against those more severe consequences of having the virus, which is the COVID-19 disease itself, which causes people to be treated medically or hospitalized and or die. And I think that the messaging out there has been a little bit confusing because people say, oh, well, even if I get the shot, I can still be infected. Well, that's true. But if you don't have a vaccine and you get infected, your risk of the more severe consequences is much higher. And that is really what we're trying to protect in public health, is from people needing to go to the hospitals. We've talked a lot about how the hospitals were overburdened during the different phases of the pandemic. And so these vaccines really help protect you in that regard, not just from getting an infection with some mild symptoms.
Right. I think it's just one of those things that it's hard to wrap your head around because you think like a shot should mean zero of anything. But I mean, I think back to the flu shot where like you could get the flu shot and still kind of get a little sick, and folks would try to blame it on the shot itself. It's like, no, you were probably already coming down with it. Like,
well, if you have symptoms of the flu right after you get the flu shot, or symptoms of COVID-19 right after you get the COVID-19 shot, that is not, you're not infected with the virus. Your body is kind of training itself to fight off the virus. So those symptoms are developed in response to your immune system learning that code and embedding it and preparing itself to fight off the actual virus. So there are a lot of people who get confused when they recently get a vaccine and then they have some symptoms. They believe that they're actually infected with the virus, when most of the time it's just their body's natural response to that vaccine rather than an actual infection.
That's interesting. And Sean, when it comes to sort of the symptoms from the vaccine, was any of that included in the research? There's these sort of, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but, you know, folks will say, well, if you have serious symptoms from the vaccine or you feel really sick, that means it's working. And if you don't have any at all, then it's not working.
Yeah, I like many things in medicine, absolute rules often don't apply. Human bodies have quite varied responses to the same treatment. And I don't think it is an absolute rule that that is the case. In fact, I'm not aware of any data, Brian may be, that suggests that people with those immediate symptoms afterwards somehow have either greater or inferior immune response to the vaccine. So I would be careful about ascribing certain, very black and white rules like that. In our study, this group that we're a part of, this nationwide initiative, is looking at vaccine effectiveness. The CDC and the FDA have other methods of looking at vaccine adverse events. There's actually something called the Vaccine Adverse Event Report. Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which tracks reports of vaccine adverse events to date. The vaccine, based on the data that we're seeing, the vaccine has its safety profile has been consistent with what the clinical trial showed, which showed that less than 5% of people experience even those mild symptoms. And so while our studies do not look at that, there are good data out there on that topic.
Did you utilize at all there's this app, like after you get vaccinated, that you track your symptoms and stuff like that? Did that factor at all into the study?
We did not use that, no, but that is a very interesting, that's a great app, and we need, again, to better understand the information. And I think another point I'd just like to make is that, there absolutely is a great deal of confusion and misunderstanding around vaccinations and immunity and the virus. Part of the reason that Brian do the work that we're doing is to try to help people better understand. We try to provide that data. And in fact, interviews like these are intended to help cut through that confusion because we recognize that this is complex, complicated stuff. And part of the reason that messaging has been confusing is you're seeing science unfold here in many ways, where we're learning new pieces of evidence every day. But what the data clearly continues to tell us is that the vaccines are both safe and quite effective.
Yeah, and I can imagine also the headlines don't always help, because there's these sexy headlines of dramatic, and that's the first thing you see, and then you don't really read the article and you think something's wrong. But Brian, when we talk about this vaccine, I think there's concern with folks when they say, like, well, like, for example, the tetanus shot, every 10 years you get a booster. Why is that okay, but this one doesn't last as long?
Well, it's because the main reason is because this is a novel virus that has not been circulating, in humans for hundreds of years. These other viruses that are out there that we've that the human population has been exposed to many times over and have many, many, many different variants out in the natural world. That's not SARS-CoV-2. It's a novel virus. It burst onto the scene, if you will, in late 2019. And so immediately the whole human population was susceptible to this virus. And so we do believe, based on the data, that over time we probably will move to some kind of regular pattern for these booster shots for SARS-CoV-2. We think it might be annual at this point, but we don't know that until we see additional variants come into play. We have more time and experience. As Sean said, science is unfolding before our eyes. And so we're going to continue to learn what that pattern might be. So eventually we might have maybe the shot you get is every few years instead of, every 6 to 12 months.
We have about a minute left here. Sean, what are some key takeaways you hope folks will get from this research?
Sure. Well, I hope people understand that the vaccine remains effective, even though we do see decrease in that effectiveness over time. That's not unexpected. What was unexpected to me, and I think Brian made the point earlier, was the level of effectiveness that remained even after we observed the waning period. So it's very clear that vaccines protect individuals from those more severe outcomes down the road. And so we think it's important that people who are able and willing to get the vaccine do so, because the data clearly shows that it works and it protects people.
Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Sean Grannis is Vice President of Data and Analytics at the Regenstrief Institute and a Professor of Family Medicine at the IU School of Medicine. Brian Dixon is Director of Public Health Informatics at the Regenstrief Institute and Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. If you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. As we continue our discussion on vaccines, there are some promising results that look into the COVID-19 vaccine and pregnant women. With us now to talk more about that is Dr. Camuel Wright, OBGYN, and Vice President and Market Chief Medical Officer with CareSource. I read about this recent study of vaccinated women who are pregnant and how the COVID-19 vaccine can actually help their baby as well. Can you explain what this study is and what this all means?
Absolutely. So I think that there are some basic things that we should review even before getting into that. So what we know is that obviously we're 2 years into a pandemic, and we're fortunate enough to have a vaccine for COVID, which hopefully will help us eventually turn the tide and get ahead of the virus. We know that the vaccine is both safe and recommended for pregnant women. So many thought leaders in the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine, the CDC, et cetera, have released statements about the safety and the efficacy of the vaccine in terms of preventing serious illness in pregnancy. So we've had a body of evidence and thought around how there's obvious maternal benefit for the COVID vaccine. I think what's really exciting about the information that's come out recently is that we now have some evidence that in addition to protecting the mom, it actually will protect the baby as well. So what we know from research is that the vaccine itself, so the components of the vaccine, do not cross the placenta, so those do not get to the baby. So for anyone who maybe has concerns about the safety of the vaccine, they should take that as a reassuring sign. What does cross the placenta and get to the baby is the antibodies. So those all-important cells that the mom makes that helps her to fight infection, and in this situation, COVID, those do pass over to the baby. And so when the mom gets vaccinated, not only does she protect herself, but she can actually share some of that protection, some of that immunity with her baby. And what the most latest research shows is that babies who are born to moms who have been vaccinated do actually show protection from COVID and are much less likely to be hospitalized in early life. And I think that that's key. We know that there's no vaccine that babies can get right now. And so there's no other way to protect the baby. But it's really nice to know that that mom's protection can actually demonstrate some protection for the baby as well.
There are so many different studies being released all the time, and the science is constantly changing. Do you think this causes confusion for people who are unsure about whether to get vaccinated, let alone get vaccinated while pregnant?
So I certainly hope that it helps to alleviate some fears and actually reduces some confusion. So I speak a lot about this topic. Obviously, as new moms or new parents, you want to do the best you can for your developing infant. And I think that, you know, everyone is trying to understand the virus and the vaccine and the potential effects of the vaccine. And what I have tried to let people know, again, is that we do have evidence, we have studies, and we actually have some registries where people who've been vaccinated can go on and speak about their experience. And all of that information shows, again, that the vaccine is safe and effective. So that's part of the story. I think the other part of the story is what the effects are for the baby. And I hope that studies like this really help to fill in that that question for parents as they're trying to make this decision, and hopefully be an extra incentive to go ahead and get that immunization.
What are the possible consequences of not getting vaccinated and, for example, contracting COVID while pregnant or after delivery?
So they're actually very, very serious. So what we know is that when a woman is pregnant, there are changes in her immune system. And many of those changes come into effect so that she does not attack the growing fetus. And so some things don't work as well. And for that reason, we know that pregnant women who do contract the virus are much more susceptible for having very serious consequences. And unfortunately, we've even had some women who have died from the virus. We know that if a pregnant woman gets COVID, she's much more likely to end up in the hospital. She's much more likely to require treatment in the intensive care unit. She's much more likely to need a ventilator, so to be put on a breathing machine. And she's much more likely to need advanced technology. So there's something called ECMO, which is a really advanced treatment for people who are critically ill. And unfortunately, we know that the risk of death is higher for pregnant women who contract the virus. So it's incredibly serious. As you might imagine, a pregnant woman's body is supporting two individuals. Her heart and lungs are working overtime. And so this virus that attacks the heart and lungs does even more damage in the pregnant woman. And that's why it's really critical for pregnant women to consider getting vaccinated.
It's interesting what you're saying, because I think a lot of us don't hear that angle. We're just hearing pregnant women should get vaccinated. But just the way you talk about, you know, the heart and the lungs working overtime and how it's even more risky for pregnant women, that really opens our eyes, I think, to that.
There's some other just really new information coming out that in addition to those things that I talked about, pregnant women who have COVID also are at increased risk for preterm delivery, which of course has various serious consequences for the baby, and you know, having consequences of prematurity. In addition, we know preeclampsia, which is a very serious condition that typically happens at the end of pregnancy, where a woman has high blood pressure and some other physiologic consequences. We have seen that the likelihood of that is increased in pregnant women with COVID as well. So even if a woman doesn't have these very serious consequences during her infection, the aftermath of the infection can also jeopardize her health and the health of the baby as well. So I just really can't emphasize enough how critical it is to try to do everything to protect the pregnant woman, including vaccination.
Have you seen vaccination hesitancy among pregnant women? Is that a large number of the population, or are they more likely to get vaccinated?
Unfortunately, hesitancy is very common in this population, and it's for the reasons we've talked about. Parents are trying to make the best decision for their children. There's lots of new emerging information, and sometimes that information can be hard to process. So unfortunately, we know that only about 30 to 40% of pregnant women are vaccinated, and that's way too low. You know, we wanna push that number as close to 100 as we can, knowing that we'll never get there. But vaccine hesitancy is incredibly high in this population. We also know that women who are planning a pregnancy oftentimes will be reluctant to get vaccinated because, again, they're worried about the consequences. And really, this is the best time to get vaccinated. You really kind of want your immunity to be as strong as possible against the virus even before you conceive. We know that the risk of stillbirths has been shown to be higher with pregnant women who have become infected with COVID. So really, to set yourself up for success, you want to get that immunity even before you get pregnant. There are women who are concerned about fertility, and that sometimes will lead to vaccine hesitancy. And I will just say that those concerns are unfounded as well. We know that pregnant women we know that many women have gone on to be pregnant, both in the studies and now that the vaccine has been released, and we haven't seen any negative consequences in terms of fertility or, again, in pregnancy. They've even done some studies in men and whether the vaccine affects their fertility, and that has been shown to not be an issue as well. So, you know, absolutely a population that has hesitancy, and I hope that by getting this information out, we can help to combat some of that.
I wonder if part of the hesitancy is when you're pregnant. I mean, my experience was many, many years ago, so maybe the rules have changed, but I remember there were things like certain cheeses you can't eat or deli meat if it wasn't cooked, and things that you just felt like it was just a list of things piling. You can't get a filling at the dentist. Do you think this stuff can be intimidating so that, you know, someone who's pregnant is like, hold up, I'm not going to do anything until after I have this baby?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a lot of it, because there are definitely recommendations for safe living during pregnancy that, you know, is the things that you talked about, avoiding soft cheeses, avoiding undercooked meat, that sort of thing. This is a completely different category. So this is a medicine that has been evaluated in studies, has had a lot of clinical research behind it, has been authorized or approved by the FDA, has been endorsed by many thought leaders, and felt to be safe. So I think that, again, so much information is coming at you when you're pregnant that it sometimes is very difficult to know what to do. And sometimes people will err on the side of, I'm just not going to do anything right now. And I would say that there is certainly potential harm in looking at it that way. And so people should, again, look at the research, look at towards, you know, the guidance that's put out, and really regard this as being safe.
Do you think the messaging around getting vaccinated against COVID has been enough to encourage pregnant women, or is there more to be done?
I think there's always opportunity to do more. So again, there's certainly a body of research and evidence that supports this. There are many evidence-based organizations that have guidelines around this, but I don't know that that message is getting out to the public as effectively as it could. So I think opportunities like this to come on your show really is helpful. I think social media can sometimes be a double-edged sword. So I think that this is something really good to put out on social media to combat some of the misinformation that will be out there. And then I really think providers need to make sure that they're telling relevant people, women in childbearing age ranges, as well as pregnant women, this important information to help guide their decision making. So I don't think the message is as prevalent as it needs to be.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that misinformation spreads so quickly, you know, negative stories versus the reality of and the facts, that those for some reason take forever to get to people.
It does. I mean, there's lots of sort of behavioral science that says that negative information spreads much faster than positive information. I mean, we know that with Yelp reviews and Google reviews, you know, yeah. The negative ones are much more positive, much more powerful than the positive ones. So unfortunately, the same is the case for COVID and vaccination. People who spread misinformation in social media groups and other forums, that seems to take hold better than some of the more positive evidence-based information. And so I just think we need to stay out there and try to get this message across.
What would you say things look like here in Indiana for pregnant women and vaccination?
Mm-hmm. So the rates are still low. You know, we're still definitely hovering around that 30-40% and even lower in certain populations. And so I think there's much work to be done in this space. My organization, CareSource, is doing several vaccination clinics around the state with the Indiana Immunization Coalition. And we certainly encourage all people, including pregnant women, to come to those events. We are also looking at maybe having some events that are particularly geared to pregnant women, where again, we can give them this information and then offer vaccinations if necessary. We're doing our part to get in front of providers in Indiana, make sure that they are equipped with the proper information and they can share that information with their patients. I think the Department of Health has done a really great job of putting information on their website. So if you want to go to in.gov/coronavirus, there's a wealth of statistics that are updated regularly, as well as some information on how to get the vaccine. So I think that there are lots of people doing great work here in Indiana, but there is still much work to be done.
We have about a minute left here before we wrap up. How do things look so far for women's health in general in Indiana with COVID?
Mm-hmm. So I think in many spaces, and women's health is no exception, people have taken a break from getting important health care because of reluctance to go into the doctor's office. So what we know is that people are less likely to get pap smears, less likely to get mammograms, less likely to get testing for sexually transmitted infections, and less likely to get their routine screening for heart disease and diabetes and things of that nature. And those all have negative consequences. What we're starting to see is that diseases are being recognized at a more advanced stage and really hindering our ability to effectively treat them. So I would absolutely recommend that every woman get into her doctor, have her annual visit, make sure that she is caught up on all her routine testing and screening, make sure that all her medical conditions are optimized, make sure that she gets her COVID vaccination, her flu vaccination, anything else that she might be due for, because we really want to make sure that people are as healthy as possible and in the best shape to fight an infection should they contract it.
Well, thank you so much for that reminder and for joining us, Dr. Camille Wright, OBGYN and Vice President and Market Chief Medical Officer with CareSource. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you to all of you for tuning in. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Mikey Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, find it wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.